Man, welcome to Crossroads. If you are newer today, we're excited to have you with us. You just dropped into our most intense season, perhaps in 15 years of Crossroads history, and a week before our most important weekend, which is next weekend. Next weekend, all of us who are part of Crossroads, part of the Crossroads team, are going to be able to make financial commitments above and beyond what we regularly give for 3 years. And we're doing this to fund the dreams that we just saw in that video. We're noticing that this place is full. It's getting fuller, and actually Mason campus is growing faster than Oakley, and we have a dream of having people reach all over the city and different sites of Crossroads popping up, which also gives us a wider infrastructure to financially sustain the big splashes we're making in the world, such as the CityLink Center. We have a dream to end generational poverty here in our city, to help people who are the working poor just go to a new place, and the CityLink Center, we believe, is the best model to take that forward. We have a dream that in the nation of South Africa, we will be able to see medical clinics give people basic medical care. And today we're going to talk about aftercare homes in India and our efforts to end the sex slave industry and bring girls into wholesome environments where they can recover and rehabilitate. So that's where we are today. And in a little bit, we're going to have the opportunity to take up an offering. If you're newer today, man, we're just excited for you to be here. And hopefully you can just feel good to sit back and receive. But if you call this place home, you know, this is how we fund the basic day in, day out life change that happens here and all across the globe. Before we do that, a couple of things for you. First is Thanksgiving food drive. Yes. Many of us have our boxes already. I hope you still get boxes. We'd love to get all those boxes gone because it shows that we're going to be able to give a lot of people Thanksgiving meals in our city who normally wouldn't, and also people basic food items over in South Africa. So here's the deal. We've got three different stations here in this building. Go to those stations, get a box. They'll give you a card that'll give you the instructions for everything to do, and we'll be bringing it back in 2 weekends, not next weekend, the weekend after. That we'll be bringing it back. And when we do that, when you do that, you got to make sure you bring it back. So if you take a box, that's cool. Bring it back. Because as soon as you take that box, it sets a whole thing, series of things in motion where we tell families, we got to cover. You're going to have a full Thanksgiving meal. And if you don't bring it back, you are a loser. Those people cry because they're unhappy and God sends you to hell. You don't want any of those three things to happen. Hell might be actually a little more intense. It might happen to you, but you know the point. Hey, man, it's great. Be involved with it and definitely fulfill the commitment you make. That's very, very important. It's going to be fun. It's like liquid love around here this time of year as those boxes are taken. And before we take a look at a story here, I want to let you know that today we are looking at India. And if you've got kids in here, as we say all the time, they should always be in Kids Club. It's a much better environment for them. But today, we're going to be talking very graphically about what happens in India and what we're doing. And so, and actually for you too, I mean, if you're not really interested in graphic, real things, this is not the day for you. In the church world in America, Christians are regularly accused of sticking their head in the sand, not seeing the real issues of the day, and unfortunately, that's all too often a very true thing. We're going to be talking today about how girls that we're rescuing and helping rehabilitate give force 200 to 400 blowjobs a month. And I intentionally use that word in order for it to be catalyzing. We hear sex slavery, they go, oh yeah, bad stuff happens. No. Forced, awful, heinous things happen. It is not good, and we're going to end it. And we're going to talk about that today, how that's actually going to happen. But this is going to be the tenor of our entire service. So if you want to play church, go find someplace else today. This is not the place for you to do that. We're going to take a look at how one couple right now has been experiencing this journey and what they're processing how to give and commit to next weekend. And while they do that, we're going to have volunteers take up an offering with little bags we'll pass down your aisle. So let's check this out.
I am not really all that big on Christian lingo, but I really do get what that means, that idea of being saved, and that my life really has been saved through all the things that have happened to us since we've been a part of Crossroads.
And I remember a real profound moment in one of the services, kind of experiencing this feeling of here's Christ on the cross, forgiving the people who were driving nails and thorns into his hands and killing him, because for some odd reason, God wanted a relationship with us, each one of us, and he wanted a relationship with me.
I think the biggest thing for me was that I started giving myself more grace. I think up to that point, I was so hard on myself, and I had a ton of guilt over just life choices I had made, and I think that actually kept me away from God. Really, at Crossroads, learning that God wasn't holding any of those things against me, and that God wanted a relationship with me, and that I was just as important, was huge. I just started to feel like I counted and like I mattered, and I think that was reflected in everything I did.
We were in a service, and we were asked to meditate, and during that meditation, was God trying to tell us anything or push us in a different direction?
So my husband and I are both praying, and we go home and we sit down on the couch, and he says,
I think God was urging me to reconsider this whole thing with family.
And what was amazing was the same thing had come to me during the exact same service at the exact same time. So it was just unbelievable that we just really felt like at that point we had taken all the things that made sense to us and put them out on the table for God, and that was something that he was really asking of us. What was really hard too is that after that happened, we didn't get pregnant for a long time. I started to wonder again, what is it that's not okay about me that God has said, hey, yeah, you're not good enough. So that was really, really probably one of the most profound times in my faith, because I knew that it was 100% up to God.
So then we went through this long journey of trying to do that. We go through this prayer service where we're just blown away by the profound faith that people had in saying, God, we boldly ask you to bless this couple with a child, which he did.
And that's why we named her Grace, because I know I didn't earn her, but I know that it really was God saying, here, you know, this is my gift.
At that moment, we were kind of going through this huge growth spurt of, now we're going to take on a family. And then we had a chance to participate in the crazy campaign.
It was pretty amazing for my husband and I, because at that point, I think it was the first time that we really, really got the idea of kind of opening the floodgates and saying, hey, you know, like, God doesn't do just enough for us. He never, ever, ever gives us in fair ration. And we are being so stingy with how we are letting things flow through us relative to how he's given to us. And so we just got really bold.
It's so overwhelming, the abundance in our life, and how many blessings came from God, that we got to do more than this. We've got to be playing a significant role.
I just remember feeling like we were on a roller coaster ride, because we were so giddy and terrified all at the same time, because we couldn't believe the commitment we wanted to make. But it finally felt right. And so I think it really shifted how we thought about cheerful giving.
It's been so interesting to be retrospective and just kind of think back, and 10 years ago when we first started coming here, what was my life like, and how were the profound changes that took place, how were they affected by Crossroads? And then I come out of the other end and say, hey, this has been an abundant place, and I've got to go beyond what's comfortable to what could be abundant.
We've just really been praying a lot. We've been listening a lot to what we really think God is asking for from us. We sold our company 2 years ago, and the third installment of that is due to come in November. At this point, we believe what God's asking is that we take half of that. For us, what it's meaning is that there's a very good chance that we're sacrificing how early my husband can retire. But it's crazy, because my husband's a financial planner. So what he does for a living is plan exactly what needs to happen. So for us, it's phenomenal, because it's really us saying, hey, you know, that financial independence. We talk all the time in our business about financial freedom, and the definition of that in the financial planning world is financial freedom is you have enough money that you no longer are required to work for income. But, you know, really for us, financial freedom has become really looking at, hey, this isn't ours. This is all God's. And if we're not kind of keeping our hearts open to how he wants to use it, it really doesn't matter whether or not we're bound to work or not bound to work. You know, we don't have the freedom that we're talking about.
I think the easiest way for me to approach it in a joyful way is just to know that Crossroads allows me to be part of something that's so big that I could never accomplish on my own. And it's a lot of fun to be part of something that is having a profound effect that I can play a little tiny role, but without Crossroads as the vehicle, I could have never been part of something that can change Cincinnati or can change part of South Africa or change people's lives in Cincinnati and let them experience what we've experienced through Crossroads.
If my sister who lives on the west side of town ends up having a Crossroads she can go to, that'd be spectacular.
It is just fun to see what God is doing in his people. And many of his people happen to be all over this place, and it's a good journey we're on. In recap, what we've been learning is that step one is surrender. Step one is to say, God, everything that you have given me, I want to bring out on the table, everything, all my possessions, all my abilities, I want to surrender it. In fact, none of these things are mine. I didn't create these things, you created these things. And even though I worked hard that was associated with these things, you created a country called America that I could be born in, that I could work in, that provides me these abilities where if I'm born in other countries, I can never have these things. So all these things, I just want to, out of sanity, spiritual sanity, say, God, I surrender all these things to you, and I surrender everything that's going to come here on this table to you in the next 3 years. I surrender. Step number two is listen. God, is there anything that is on the table that I've surrendered, which is everything, hopefully my entire being, is there anything that you're telling me that you want back for these initiatives? And then step number three we're going to do next week is we're going to actually do. We're going to actually commit it. We're going to commit it. And I got to tell you, I know that there is a lot of us who are very hesitant. There's a lot of hesitancy about the campaign. Well, what about this? I don't understand that. And there's just a lot of hesitancy that goes around when you have big dollar figures, big projects, big churches. There's just a lot of hesitancy. And it's kept a lot of us from really fully engaging. And I got to tell you, I understand you because I am one of you. I thought it might be helpful to hear my journey as the chief hesitancy officer. It started a few years ago for me, and there were things that were popping up that we knew that needed to go forward, but it needed a large slug of cash that we did not have. We saw that starting different sites of Crossroads is going to be an amazing blessing for our city and was going to give us an ability to bite off bigger chunks around the world and have an ongoing financial infrastructure to sustain big, big projects. And yet, we didn't have the cash to actually launch those into a much fuller expression. CityLink, man, even though we've had 6 years of difficulties, and even though there's been all kind of misinterpretation or misunderstanding, Crossroads is a bunch of street fighters. We're as passionate about it now as we were before. And while we initially committed $250,000 to that, we've spent about $2 million over the last several years in legal fees, taxes, architectural fees, building permits, stuff, just all kind of things, so that we were hovering on the go button, ready to go. And yet it was going to take a lot more money to go for it. And we're going, we don't know if we have, where are we going to get that? South Africa, not good enough. Not good enough to just send people over and have some nice videos. Several years later, we got to actually make a sustainable dent in the medical condition of our brothers and sisters over there. And so as I'm wrestling with this myself a few years ago, I'm going, oh man, I don't know if I want to do this personally. I don't know if that's just where I am. Because, you know, I like my life. I like my life. I like my take-home pay, or specifically my disposable income after I pay bills and do my regular giving. I don't like the idea of more uncertainty. And you know what? I like the size of Crossroads right now. I understand it. I understand the organizational infrastructure. I like everything about Crossroads right now. I like it. And all of this change, it's going to be really, really hard. So I was really wrestling in a very, very hard way with going public and trying to push folks into thinking about a campaign. And I got a call from Gary Haugen. Gary Haugen is the founder of International Justice Mission, IJM, and he's a future Nobel Peace Prize winner. I believe he is. Gary Haugen was with the Justice Department, and then he was on loan to the UN when the Rwanda massacre happened, and he headed up the entire Rwanda massacre investigation. And a seminal moment happened in his life was when he was standing in a stadium with limbs hacked off up to his knees and realizing what has gone wrong with this world and with this place. There is a need for justice as one of God's core attributes being played out. As he finished his responsibility heading up the Rwanda investigation, he went out and he started an international justice mission, which goes to different countries, portions of the world, where there is injustice happening and the laws are on the books, but they're not being enforced. And so IJM basically serves up a plated meal to law enforcement, does the investigation, says, let's walk this through so justice is done. And he asked me to go to India with them, one of their offices are. And I never really had a big passion to go to India. I'm excited for all the things that we've done in India, the money we've put to India. I'm excited that people at Crossroads have been to India. But me, personally, I just never really wanted to go there. But when Gary Haugen called, I said, yeah, I'll go with you. Yeah, so that's cool. So Libby and I went over them, did a tour of the operations over in India. And one of the most powerful and profound days of my life, which now I look back on it, is actually a powerful and profound day in all of our lives, was when I went to an aftercare facility in Calcutta, India. Earlier in the day, I had gone to Mother Teresa's home. I'd gotten to see her bedroom. I'd got to interact with nuns that were her friends and knew her. It was a powerful, powerful experience. And then later on that late afternoon, went to an aftercare home. What happens is when somebody is rescued from sex slavery, before they're rescued, they have to make sure they have a slot in a home that meets certain standards that is government sanctioned. And these aftercare homes are critical. If there's not space in aftercare homes, then rescues aren't made. And if something good doesn't happen in the aftercare home, then they may as well be in a hellish situation. These got to be good, healthy places. I went into one of these aftercare homes, and there was like a cage. A portion of this compound was a cage, and there was all these girls in this cage. And I said to the staff afterwards, I said, "What's up with the cage?" And they said, "Sorry that it." It looks like a cage to you, but actually what it is a few things. Number one, these girls are brainwashed by their pimps from age 6 to 12 or 14, whatever it is, that nobody likes you. You are not valued, and if anybody ever takes you, they're going to do awful things to you. So they are brainwashed to escape and run away any place that they leave. So it's partially to contain them in. And the pimps are very violent. They're going to want to get the property back. And they want to break in and get them. So we have to protect and keep the pimps out. And they said, and these girls are so whacked emotionally, psychologically, spiritually, intellectually, every way, that if they go in with a common, with everybody else who's been basically in rehab for, you know, a couple years or so, they could cause them to regress. And finally, we don't have the staff to do anything more with them right now. You know, one of the ways that the game is played in our society, and many of us have bought into this too, the way the game is played in the nonprofit world is to get big donors who normally have businesses and have started infrastructures and therefore understand the value of infrastructure, the value of staff, the value of these things, and have them big checks that fund these things. And then you come to little quote unquote stupid peons like you and I and say, 95 cents of every dollar goes, we go, oh, good, good. So we have this poo-poo idea towards administrative costs. That's because we don't understand how any change happens when people who are big donors do understand that. Let me tell you something. We can build all the aftercare homes we want, and if we don't pay for administrative costs of staffing, of counselors that actually bring these girls to wholeness, it's ridiculous. Doesn't work. No good. And so I had a I wrestle with that all the time at Crossroads, and you too, you people do too. Interesting how ministry is often the same on different parts of the planet. And I went into a meeting after that with some of the girls who were growing and becoming whole and some of the staff. And I'll never forget this girl. It was Molly. She was sitting on this chair in this circle. And I first saw her from behind. And she was hunched up like this. And when I saw her from behind, I thought that she was physically deformed. And when I came around and entered the circle and I actually was able to look at her, I saw that her face was up. And her eyes were just wide open, darting left and right. And I thought, all right, this is actually a person who's assumed the posture of a beat dog. I've seen that look before. Involuntarily making herself small so that no one notices her, and looking around hoping that nobody hits her. This was a girl that must have been clubbed and beaten in her brothel. As we left that aftercare home, it was now dark, and Libby and I were in the back seat with Gary Haugen. In the front seat was another IJM guy by the name of Don. And for me, this was another example of why there needed to be a campaign. But man, there were so many reasons not to do this, and I had so much hesitancy of jumping in further into some other foreign country that I needed some information. So I asked Gary, I said, Gary, how many homes do you need to alleviate the aftercare crisis in India? And he said, I don't know. Don, how many homes do we need? And this guy, Don, would answer. I said, well, how much does that cost? And he said, I don't know. Don, how much would that cost to do all that? And Don would answer. And I said, well, what if we sent over volunteers and we actually built them ourselves? Could we save money that way? How much would that cost? He said, I don't know, Don, could we do that? And Don said, no, you can't do that because you have the local trades, and local trades are hurting financially, and this is already a difficult thing to have aftercare home in their neighborhood. If you come in and they perceive you as taking away jobs, it'll never go, it won't work. And I said, interesting. Every answer this guy, Don, had the answer to, every question he had the answer to. And on a bumpy seat, I did a fleece prayer. Fleece prayers, they're in the Bible. There's one time in the Bible, and a fleece prayer is a weenie prayer. A fleece prayer is a prayer someone prays when they want incontrovertible scientific evidence of what God's will is. And unfortunately, you will never get that. In fact, if you're waiting to make any commitment until you get incontrovertible proof, you will never make commitments. That's why many of us never make commitments. And this weenie prayer actually was done by Gideon. Gideon was told by God to go do certain things, and Gideon said, I'm not sure I heard you right. I'll tell you what, I'm gonna put out a fleece. If the fleece is dry in the morning and the ground is wet, then I'll assume, God, that you spoke to me. Does that, and that's exactly what happens. Then afterwards he says, maybe that wasn't the case. So he puts out the fleece, says, God, make the fleece wet and the ground dry. God does the exact opposite. So now he's forced into it. And so I basically, in a weenie moment, I said, God, you know, I will take it that you want us to go forward with this campaign and you want us to solve the aftercare crisis in India if you bring this guy, Don, from India, who's been serving and leading the Calcutta office for 4 years, we bring him to Cincinnati. I offered Don a job that day. I've never offered anybody a job on the spot, never hired a friend of mine from Pittsburgh or anything like that. And this guy, on the spot, a couple months later, he accepted. And a year later, I found myself going over to a house that he was staying in for a while, his first night in Cincinnati, taking Dewey's Pizza over there, and having a very deeply deep moment because God had just spoken. Something had miraculous that had just happened. So if you're hesitant that we're in a campaign, it's all Don Jared's fault. Let's welcome up on stage right now. Don, come on up.
Thank you.
How dare you say yes to a big vision? You've ruined my life.
My pleasure.
Oh, goodness. Don, my pleasure. You worked in a prosecutor's office. You were in the narcotics division. You packed heat in America. You would stand behind people in SWAT suits busting down doors. You go from there over to India. Your family is in danger. People find out what you do. They come after you. You're in the heat of adrenaline-charged ministry. And now you're on staff at a church. Did you ever imagine yourself working and looking at Bible screensavers?
No. No, I really didn't. I mean, I went to church, but the church that I went to, good people, but you know, I find myself out with the cops, and you know, if you, the drug business works that you arrest somebody and then you're asking them, you know, where'd the dope come from? And the conversations
you
have.
And you ask them in a very nice way.
Well, yeah, you pray with them first. And not really. And I sort of ask myself, you know, wow, this doesn't really fit the churchy world. But, you know, the thing that's really been good about being here is that this community doesn't ask you to live a double life. It doesn't ask you to pretend to be something or someone that you're not, to sort of learn some sort of a weird Christian code in order to fit. And so this has been a really great place for us to land. Glad to be here.
Give us the macro view of what's happening in India and what we're doing.
Sure. On May 9th of 2009, the director of the Indian CBI, which is their version of the FBI, told the media that he estimated that at any given moment, there are about 3 million females in forced prostitution in India. And he estimated that about one-third of those are children. And if you do the math, that comes out to about 1.2 or 1.3 million children in sex slavery. And when I say slavery, I don't mean a metaphor. I don't mean something like slavery. I mean actual slavery. I mean slavery as in you can't leave. Slavery as in your owner can do anything he wants to you. Actual slavery. You know, I own a car, and I don't intentionally damage it, but there is something about owning another human being that just brings out the worst form of malice and contempt in people. Mm.
So what was it like then to do raids? How'd that work?
Well, you know, we work with local authorities to try to bring about, to make the public justice system work, and I had a team with me of lawyers, social workers, investigators, and an admin support staff, and we did actual cases. I mean, unlike other organizations that write reports, which is a good thing to do, we took on actual cases. So I had a team of investigators who would go out into the brothels, into the red light areas, posing as customers so that they could sort of search through and find the women who had been recently trafficked and wanted out the children who were being held in the brothels. And you know, that's sort of how we would find it. We'd take evidence to the local authorities, ask them to take action to do rescues.
Now, before we go further, let me just say something where some of us might be feeling right now. Some of us are emotionally right now, maybe even intellectually, and perhaps about to physically just go, you know what? Don't want to hear about this. Not the kind of stuff I want to think about when I'm in churchy time. And, you know, maybe it's a big problem, but that's Indian government's got to deal with that. That's them, you know, not me. I would just remind you or inform you for the first time, if you haven't heard it before, of a key passage in the Bible from the book of Matthew chapter 25, where Jesus is dealing with two categories of people who deal with difficult issues in two different ways. And it comes this one group of people, and they get classified as the sheep. And he says, you, man, you've taken care of me. You've looked after me. Come with me. We're going to enjoy a relationship for eternity. And these people go, what are you talking about? When were we with you? I didn't really know you. He said, no, whenever you did it for the least of these, you've done it for me. Whenever you saw somebody hurting, whenever you reached out a hand to somebody who was abused, whenever somebody was devalued by the rest of people and you looked after them, I took that person, he looked after me. And then it says another group of people who come to be known as the goats. It says, you people, get away from me out in the darkness. Just get away from me. You don't care about me. You didn't help me at all. And people say, what are we talking about, Jesus? When do we ever see you not take care of you? You always have. He said, when you haven't done it for the least of these, I take it personal. You haven't done it for me. You're not about love. You're about fear. You're not about love. You're about hesitancy. And you don't really want me because you don't want to have anything to do with the marginalized in society. This is the marginalized in society. And we at Crossroads, we look at these as the least of these. And when we serve girls this way, we serve Jesus. We serve Jesus, and that's why we're talking about this today, and that's why we're going forward.
That's really true. You know, the investigators that you know, I say we had a team of investigators, a lot of you are probably thinking about like detectives. But the detectives that I worked with doing narcotics enforcement, these guys had Glock 40 pistols, they had Kevlar vests, they had badges, they had radios, they had high-tech equipment, and they had backup. And these investigators that we have are, other than who's the director of investigations, who's my partner who you met, who's like a Marine and a SWAT guy and an undercover guy, these guys go out posing as customers, walking the walk on a regular, you know, four nights a week, and take on tremendous risk because they are drawn to the beauty that is presented when these girls get rescued. The red light areas are horrifically bad places. There's a red light area in Calcutta called Sonagachi. It is, the word is in Bangla, it means golden tree. And this red light area has between 10 to 50,000 commercial sex workers in it. The video that you're looking at right now is undercover footage taken in Sonagachi. It's undercover because the enforcers that guard the lanes as you go in will get very upset if they see you carrying a camera. They don't want the outside world to see what goes on here. Every woman that you see is a commercial sex worker. And the thing is that these lanes are not nearly what they will look like in just a couple hours from the time this is shot. It's early evening, it's not fully dark yet. When it does get dark, the lanes on both sides will be jammed so you can't even get a vehicle through. And you'll see girls as far as the eye can see into the haze of the night. At each lane, as you turn down each intersection, you'll see the same thing.
The real young ones are kind of sequestered behind the front doors here. They're not as much put out and open.
Well, when the traffickers get a new victim, what they do is they take, for example, the really young ones and recently trafficked adults, and they put them, you know, under lock and key because they might run. There is a process of breaking down that the traffickers use very, very consistently. And that is because they are mercenaries who are making money from these girls, and they don't want them to run, and they don't want them to not cooperate with customers. So they will begin to work on the worldview of these girls from the moment they take them. They'll tell them, you know, we've had traffickers sell a girl into a home, and taking the money right in front of her, looks at her and says, this is your fate, this is your destiny. And to the Eastern mindset, that's a very powerful concept. That this is just how it turns out for you. And they tell them, you know, you can't go back to your village because you're just going to be shunned there. And they know that's true because what's on the outside is not as important as what's on, or what's on the inside is not as important as what's on the outside for many folks there. And they tell them, you know, if the police come and get you, they're just going to put you in jail. They're just going to put you in jail. So, you know, this is what you've got to do. And after, you know, you're talking about 11-year-old, and we rescued a lot of 11-year-olds. The youngest we rescued was 8. They're dependent on their captors, and it just breaks them down. So they keep them under lock and key, but you look through the doorways, you can see girls just seated. There's a Nepali brothel on this lane that just dozens of girls seated on the stairs as you look in. They look really young, but that's not even as young as they get.
Hesitancy and fear is a common tactic of the enemy to keep us from loving. Oh, yeah. But at the same time, love casts out fear. In fact, the book of 1 John chapter 4, it talks about that. It says, there is no fear in love. Perfect love casts out fear. We love because he first loved us. There was this concept that convicted me years ago and said, man, my hesitancy is just plain old fear, and I've got a love gap in my heart between where I am now and where God is with his people. And the level of fear those investigators deal with is intense as they do their job.
It is.
These are Sunday school workers, right? Like
they
basically
are.
If we went, got kids club volunteers and said, we need you to undercover work and just go find perverts and go into this brothel.
Right. We could either, I mean, there was two choices to find, you know, investigators from. One are sort of reformed, you know, criminals who've become Christians. But they break down fast and easy in a red light area. You can't rely on them. Mm. And the other is just to go to Sunday school teachers and teach them how to walk the walk and talk the talk and play the role of a customer, which is an exhausting and dangerous and morally degrading experience. And, you know, the places that they go can be exceptionally violent. And it's very dangerous for the girls to talk to them, you know, at all. And the pimps don't want people in just from the outside. They're aware that there are organizations that are looking to do rescues. And what they're doing is secret. I mean, they're engaged in a criminal enterprise. And they know that if, you know, these girls talk, that is hazardous to their health.
Show us this undercover photos and walk us through what happened in this situation.
Sure. Yeah, the photos that we're looking at, this is the brothel where Mala was taken from. And we have a pretty thick skin doing this work, but this place was the most violent brothel that we dealt with during my time in India. What you see in that picture, the man in the striped shirt is a customer, and he is in this place, and he wants to choose a girl, and he is choosing that little girl right there. I estimate her to be about 12 years of age. And as we progress through the photos, also, as you see in the back, there's a sort of a dim figure in the back, and that is the brothel manager. His name's Boppy. And watch what happens as we progress through. He reaches out, the customer does, to grab that little girl, and she does not want to be taken. And then entering into the picture is this young lady who we actually ended up rescuing later. What she is doing is about to show you what life in the brothel is like. The girl is pulling away from the customer. See how her hand is up? Let go of me. And this woman is actually putting herself physically between the customer and this little girl. And you see the smile on her face? She's not smiling because she's happy. She's smiling because she is walking a razor's edge right now. This is a violent place, and she has been trained about the act that she is supposed to put on with customers. And if she doesn't put it on, she can get hurt. And I mean killed. And she is trying to protect that girl. But Boppy walks in, and the item in his right hand is a large wooden club. And this is how this brothel operated. And the owner of this one owned 8 more just like it. And Boppy's going to go off and deal with this little girl who wouldn't cooperate. And that is what these investigators see on a regular basis.
And where's Boppy now?
Boppy was arrested by the police, and the owner of the brothel was also arrested and is sitting in the presidency jail in Calcutta awaiting trial. He's looking at a life sentence, and he's possibly looking at hanging. I wanted to tell you is that when we got these girls out, Mala and that one girl you saw and the other, that Mala's not a real name, that's a pseudonym. We protect the identities.
Her real name's Betsy.
Her real name's Betsy, yes. We protect the identities of victims of sexual abuse, especially minors. When we got these women out, they had forgotten 3 of them and left them locked in a room, and we eventually, through pretty miraculous circumstances, got Mala out. These women cooperated immediately, which is very, very unusual. The traffickers groom these women not to cooperate, and they are quite serious about it, and it usually takes a process to get them to talk. But in this case, the violence in this brothel was so bad, was so horrific, that the pimps had actually done their job too well. So Mala was rescued last, and the first 3 were at the police station, and Mala comes in and robotically starts to tell what she's been trained to tell, which is, I'm, you know, over 18, I came here voluntarily, I like this work. And the other 3 ladies just looked at her and said, you're lying. You need to tell the truth, because we need to get out of here. Mm-hmm. And from the debrief that night, we learned that Mala saw her friend beaten to death in front of her. Her friend's body was thrown in a river. She herself tried to escape about a month in, and the owner caught her and beat her with one of those clubs. And they told us about abuse that is frankly so obscene that I can't even describe it for you here. And this is what her life was like in this place. It was just beyond belief.
So let's turn the corner right now. Hope. How can we have hope in this? Arrests. Big deal, arrests. People get arrested here, they get let out in 3 years, go back to what they did before. Why is this going to change?
I mean, what we learned in 4 years in Calcutta is that what we are engaged in is a battle for hope. The courts, we found out early on, if we didn't have girls cooperating, the courts were not interested in our undercover video. They could not care less. It is a grossly overburdened justice system that the Indian government inherited from the British. The British built one system in India and built a very, very different system at home. The system they built in India was designed to control the population while wealth was extracted. It was not designed to provide equal justice for the poor. So when we would show up with anything other than a girl who would stand in the dock and say, it was that guy, that's the guy who, and this is what he did, and I want justice. Until you have a girl who has enough faith in you, has enough trust to know that she's safe, and is willing to testify, you're not putting anybody in jail. You're not even going to keep them in on bail. The police don't even want to do rescues if the girls are, you know, demoralized and are just flaking out because you've got, you know, crappy aftercare homes. And I've seen some really bad aftercare homes. I mean, aftercare homes with no furniture of any kind, where the girls are treating their lice infection with kerosene and coconut oil, you know. I mean, just really bad stuff. And if you go and do a rescue, we're trying to establish a bond with these girls from the moment we take them out. We have female social workers and female lawyers that go in with the police, actually in to the brothel, which is a scary thing. I mean, there are situations where we've had over 1,000 people. There are big crowds in India, about 1,000 people come and surround the place, and we got our ladies inside. And but our objective is to establish a bond of trust right from the beginning. Because if you don't convince these girls that they're safe, The traffickers win. The girls will get re-trafficked because they won't cooperate. Perps won't go to jail. The police will get demoralized and not want to do the cases. And the fact is that the public justice system in India can work because we've seen it work in other places. And there's not a workaround. If you're poor, you can't hire like security guards, and you can't hire, you know, some sort of arbitrator to work around the justice system. The justice system either works for you or you get nothing.
So we're basically using godly fear by prosecuting, having an awful existence in a jail, which disincentivizes people from dealing in this kind of work. Once that happens, things change. But for there to be more rescues, there needs to be more aftercare homes. Talk about what our aftercare homes are going to look like and how many we're looking to do beds. You know, we're looking to do 30-ish to 70-ish million dollars on all the different projects, and most of our plans are scalable. Right. So what are we going to do in this issue area?
Well, as we plan and budget, you know, we're budgeting conservatively, like
conservatively. So yes. You're assuming everyone's cheap at Crossroads.
No, I wouldn't say that. We're just careful as we budget, but we're looking at, you know, right now we're looking at creating 200 new beds, 200 new aftercare slots. Right before I left Calcutta in 2009, the end of 2009, we had a rescue of about 50 or 60 girls in this brothel, and we had actually outstripped the ability of the aftercare homes to keep up with the rescues. We had actually filled up the homes to the point where the whole thing began breaking down. They just were completely overwhelmed. These girls take intensive care, especially when they're first brought in. And so we actually had to stand down. I had to tell the team to stand down. We had the police ready to go. And they actually ended up doing this thing 3 months after I left because a church in Texas finally stepped up and gave $50,000 to an aftercare home that then had the resources to take on, and they ended up getting 25 girls out of that place. So more beds are necessary, continuing to provide care, improved care, which Crossroads has been doing since 2008. We've been providing just huge aftercare resources to Mumbai. I was in the Calcutta office. I always ask myself, how come Mumbai gets all these resources? When am I getting these resources? But for example, trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy is a kind of group therapy that is made for child victims of trauma and for sex abuse victims, and it works best in a group, which means it is perfect for an aftercare home where resources are limited. It's actually more effective if you're working in a group. And right now, there's about 200 girls who are receiving trauma-focused cognitive behavioral therapy that would have just been getting a nice chat before that.
And social enterprise.
Social enterprise in order to create jobs to make these girls economically self-sufficient.
Talk about your most precious possession.
Yeah, this is a tapestry that the staff gave to me when we left. And those are the names of about 100 girls that we rescued. These girls, this is not all the girls we rescued, but many of them. And the girls actually made this in one of the homes. The handprints in the middle are a girl we'll call Shefali. And those other handprints are her son. And she was a girl who actually participated in a robbery of one of our investigators. And he went back in, and we went back a month later and got Shefali out. And the thing was, she was the worst victim ever, completely non-cooperative. She was pregnant. She said she wanted to throw the baby away, by which she meant she wanted to get an abortion. There was nothing we could do about it. And she basically got counseling from the aftercare staff to know what she had in her body, because the only thing she'd ever learned about sex was being raped in a brothel. And when she realized that she had a life inside of her, she it was like a light bulb came on. And she kept the baby, and she participated in all the vocational training and the education.
Final thoughts before we do one last song. I believe that Cincinnati, just like we were at the crosshairs of the Civil War and the slavery issue in our country, make it over the river, get to Cincinnati, you can be free. I believe that God has positioned us at the crosshairs of the slavery issue in India. I believe that, and next weekend, we go forward. And I know if you're at all normal or you're all like I was, there has to be some hesitancy. I'm gonna give you one verse that describes Jesus that is an amazing truth. It says this: "For you know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, yet for your sake he became poor, so that by his poverty you might become rich."
teaches Jesus didn't come around just 2,000 years ago when he was given birth by Mary. As God himself, the Son of God, he existed before all of time. He had the utter highest position of richness as only God himself could, and he forfeited much of that, taking on the form of a humble servant, a form of a human being, breaking the caste system, if you will. And that form of going richness to poverty, which actually happened when he shed blood. He shed blood. He bled, a kind of blood where he bled and gave grace and gave forgiveness to other people who deserve to be beat, people like Brian Tome. That is the posture that his followers have taken for 2,000 years, and we still take today. One of where I say, I will take what I have and I will live on less because love compels me to, and I will model the grace of God going after other people. Next week, we're going to get to do that. It's last week, we had a meeting with about 2,000 of our volunteers, and in that meeting, we decided to take up some commitments. And in the midst of that being the first time we've done that, an amazing thing happened. One woman came up to me afterwards. She said, you know, I volunteer at Crossroads, and I'm homeless. And God's told me, and I'm going to give $100 above and beyond what I do for the next 3 years. Amazing. Someone who is going to become having less than she even does. Another person, I haven't talked with them, but from what I'm told, our largest gift commitment was $600,000. And on both of those extremes, in God's eyes, I believe they're equal. In God's eyes, they are both equally valued, because the way the game is normally played is the less the 100, oh, whatever. That's a, well, this one, ooh, woo that person. I haven't even talked to the people. Woo that, no. Because in God's economy, what he asks all of us next week to show up with what we have and be willing to go away with a little less. Or a lot less. That is the message and call of Jesus. And next week, we all grow. We all grow spiritually. And next week, we drive a stake in the ground saying, these things that we're called to, they change. The game changes. Why don't we stand right now? God, as we stand, I am praying and we are preparing to sing that, God, where you lead, we'll follow next week. We will. We'll go. Where you lead, we're going to go. I pray you'd help us. Help us to hear and help us to do in the next 6 days. Amen. One other thing, next week, 11:45, we love you guys to death. You show up too late. Do not show up late next week, please. Your first act of generosity is to leave your house 15 minutes before you normally do, because we're going to need the time next week. It's going to be an amazing time, amazing time. And man, I think it's going to be a marker for us. So see you next week.